everybody. I'm an alcoholic. It's really good to be here. I used to say that I was an alcoholic, and when I'd go to meetings, people would say they're grateful alcoholics, and I used to think, how can you be grateful for this trouble, you know, for the trouble that you're in when you get here? And in early recovery, I wasn't grateful for much of anything. The big book says, I'll tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. When I was in high school, early, as far back as I can remember, drinking and having fake IDs and doing all that stuff, running around in Georgetown and all those places that I went to. I was raised in Alexandria, Virginia, so I was right there on the line to either Maryland or D.C., so we could go in either direction and get whatever we wanted to get. I mean, we all had fake IDs and stuff like that, and we just brought it across the bridge. And, I could never remember having a drink. A friend of mine, me and this guy by the name of Don, he used to drive a GTO, and we would go over to this place called Mead's Liquor, and we would buy several cases of quart bottles. And because we didn't want to haul around a cooler, we would put it in 50-gallon trash bags, pour the ice in the trash bag, lay it in the floor of the seat, and that way, as it got wet and it would sink, it would just kind of sink its level, and you'd have coolers sticking up everywhere. And we would drink out of those. You know, I don't know how many people, normal drinkers, go and buy quart bottles. As I drank more and more, we started calling them bumpers. But we would drink several of those a night. When I was in high school, I did what most of the people did. Played sports. I was in football, baseball. I wrestled for a while. Never did basketball. I'm a heavier guy, and I just can't jump very high. I did really good in that. But the darker side, the people that were hanging outside smoking and going out at nighttime and fighting and stuff like that in Georgetown and stuff, that's what I was really drawn to. I mean, I did the neat stuff, but I was drawn to what they had a little bit more than what I was doing. It seemed to be a little bit more exciting. And I seemed to go that way. And, I got out of school with just a C average, probably a D average. I just got out by the skin of my teeth. If I'd stayed any longer, they probably would have said, you really need to go and find out what you're going to do. So I got out, and I never will forget when I got out of school. There were several intermittent periods of time where you didn't drink or do anything for a while. And when I got out of school, I had a brother that was an air traffic controller in the Air Force. And I thought, what do I want to be when I grow up? And he seemed like he had a neat job. The only thing he had to do was go to work every day. And they gave him the clothes that he wore. He worked an 8-to-5 job, and he never saw any war or anything like that. And if he went to war, he was sitting behind a counter someplace saying, no land on this runway or that runway. Nobody was shooting at him, so I thought, that's a really good job. And so I went down to the recruiter, and I took all these tests and stuff, and I passed the test. And the day that I went down to enlist, the recruiter said they didn't have any slots open in air traffic control, so they had to send me to another field. So I called my brother, who was an instructor, and he said, don't do that. So I never will forget, I didn't enlist, and I walked outside, and my dad said, well, what are you going to do now? And I didn't have any idea. I don't have a clue. I said, I don't have a clue. He said, well, you want to get a job on the railroad? And I never thought about it. What the heck? It's something he's been doing. My grandfather did, his grandfather. It's a tradition. So I thought, okay, well, what the heck? And so I went on the railroad, and, at that point in time, it was one of those spells where things were clean. I was clean because I was trying to get in the Air Force. I wasn't drinking a lot. I was trying to impress people, and I had the ability then to do that. I could clean up what I needed to clean up. And I still hadn't crossed that line, that invisible line people talk about, where you can't. And so I went on the railroad, and things went really well. I can never will forget, I was working for the R&P Railroad, and I got my first payroll check. And I was walking across the tracks with that check, and I thought, how in God's name am I going to spend all this money? It was the most money I ever made in my life. I didn't have any problem from that day on to this one. I've never had problems spending money. It's something you can do naturally. But what happened when I started on the railroad, everybody drank. Everybody on the railroad drank. And, people had a pint in their bag. When we got to Monroe, Virginia, everybody had lockers, and those lockers were fifths. I mean, this was a job for me. I mean, this is great, I could come to work hungover, and I fit right in. I looked like everybody else. And the problem was a lot of the other guys, they could quit. You know, I was never one of those guys. I had friends that we would be out partying and stuff like that later in years. And this was after school, and this is when, you know, I'm working on the railroad for a while and stuff like that. And they would say, you know, I'm really catching a lot of heat here. This is really starting to interfere with my life. I think I'm going to quit for a while. And I'm like, what? You know, and they would quit and be just fine with it. They would go home and do things and stuff like that. And I just couldn't quit. I was one of those guys that had to drink to the last bottle, the last drink. And then at 3 in the morning, I was out looking for another party for anybody else that had something else to do. When the bars and stuff shut down, I was looking, you know. And it got to a point later in my life that I used to carry a fifth under the seat for when the bars closed because I didn't want to be without it. You know, I just didn't want to. I didn't want to have a time where I couldn't have it. I had to have it. I had to have something around, and I couldn't keep it at home. And well, after getting on the railroad, I was making really good money, staying at home with my folks, and that type of thing, and buying cars and partying all night long, and. I wasn't cashing all my checks. I mean, life was really good. I mean, you're living at home, no responsibility, making really good money. Life is going to be really good, especially for an alcoholic. I mean, you can make more money than you could possibly drink. You know what I mean? That's what I was doing. It was great. Life was really good. And I ran into this lady that I knew in high school, and I used to skip school and go to another school. And mess around down there because nobody really knew me, knew how bad of an act that I was. And I'd go to another school, and I knew her and her twin sister. Anyway, I made a long story short, I ended up dating her, and we got married. And it's funny because I ran into her at a point in time where I was fired from work for a while. They told me don't come back for 30 days. And it's funny, I can tell you, Pat's probably the only person that knows, but you can get fired from the railroad and you get right back. I mean, they say you don't come back for a while. And that's what I was doing for 30 days. And I ran into her, and we ended up getting married. And it was a point in time where I was running dry. Things were good. You know, I had just taken a promotion to engineer. I was going to go to engineer school to learn how to drive trains. And, you know, I had to look pretty good. So I did and went down to McDonough, Georgia to learn how to drive trains. And this is after I've been on the railroad for like 4 years. And things were good. I mean, things were looking really good. And I got back and started training as an engineer. And it's a funny thing, you know, not even two months after I got married, my wife told me that she was pregnant. I just couldn't understand that, you know. But the baby was born 9 days after we got married. And so, you know, everything had to look just right, so it did. And so anyway, I was trained as an engineer on the railroad, and things were really well. And there was I was firing on passenger trains and drinking a lot and eating a lot of speed at this point now. You know, things had progressed. I would get to a point where I couldn't keep awake from drinking all this stuff and I needed to do something to keep me up. This guy told me about some speed, little tablets you take. And I got really addicted to these little tablets. I could drink all night and take little tablets during the day. And so anyway, to make a long story short, I was firing on a passenger train and I went back to check on one of the engines we were running between Oak Ridge and almost to Charlottesville. I was back on the second engine. I hear a big bang, and the engineer wasn't paying attention to what he was doing. He was paying attention to what I should have been doing, and he turned the train over. And 6 people were killed. 62 were injured that morning at Elma, Virginia. And I can remember standing out there because after the train turned over, the only thing left was the engine. I mean, we were sitting in the middle of the country with just the engine. We had 8 engines and 8 cars, and all I had was 1 engine left. And I'm standing there thinking, God Almighty, what did I take? You know, if they were to urine test me, what did I take? And I remembered that I had speed, a bottle of speed in my bag. I ran up on the engine, got the speed, took it back down, ran down the bank, and I buried it. And, you know, it's a really bad feeling. But back then, thank God, they didn't urine test anybody. You know, a lot of the laws hadn't been enacted and stuff like that. But anyway, I got back to work, and that was a really hard time. While I was off on the railroad, they were doing the investigations and all that stuff. My drinking and stuff really picked up bad. I really got bad. And because I was starting to hate the world and everybody else. So you can imagine, well, over a period of time, my drinking and other things that I was starting to do had really gotten bad. I had met a different clientele of people on the railroad. They were doing this thing called, it was kind of like an affirmative action program. They would hire people coming right out of jail, and they would train them. And the federal government would pay 95% of their salary while the railroad would train them to be, you know, railroad employees. And that was a really good thing. Well, I met a bunch of these guys. And they had things that they could show me that I didn't know about, and they showed me a lot of stuff. And I learned a lot of bad things. And that stuff really progressed my life into, you know, other different things. Other than alcohol, I got into a lot of bad stuff. And it really, you know, one way it was bad, another way it was good, because it really accelerated my bottom very fast. I had a home now and was, you know, working regular on the railroad and drinking regular, and I had a child, and another one had been born in the meantime, and, while I was off being fired from that accident that I just told you about, I started a company, putting on siding, doors, and windows. I was one of those guys, you know, if I could just learn a trade, I would pick it up, and, you know, it's funny, because I was staying out back in this townhouse that I bought, thinking, you know, what am I going to do? Here I am fired, and I got a mortgage payment, and there was a guy out there, and he was putting on siding. Him and his helper had a fight, and the guy walked off. And I'll take that job. So I walked over there and said, you need a helper? And he says, you got a tape? And I said, yeah. And that guy taught me how to do aluminum siding. Can you imagine? You know, I always thought that was luck. I think it was God, you know, looking out for me, because, you know, I just never really bottomed that quick. And sure enough, I did that, and things got really good, you know, with me and this guy. I started selling scrap metal and doing really well with that. And I went to Ocean City with my wife, and we went down there and drinking, and the kids played in the sand and came back. And sure enough, in Lorton, Virginia, had a big hailstorm, beat all the siding off the side of every townhouse in that building on the west side. So I told him, I said, well, listen, I'll do all the siding here for half the insurance. You keep half, and I'll keep half. So I was really making that. I ripped it off, took that to the scrap man, and put brand new stuff up. And it was really good. But, you know, you can imagine somebody doing that and working all night long, putting on siding all day long and taking speed and drinking. I mean, I was really wearing myself down. My addiction was picking up, and everybody was starting to know. I couldn't hide it from people anymore. People were asking me what was wrong. My dad was asking me what was wrong. And a lot of things happened in between, and I just won't go into that. But anyway, what happened was I started getting a lot of heat. There was a lot of heat on me. And people were, you know, starting to ask a lot of stupid questions that I thought were stupid. You know, what's the matter with you? You're not acting right. You're not talking right. And you look bad. And stuff like that. So I took and went to a guy at work called an EAP, an employee assistance person, and I told him that I had a problem. And it wasn't that. I mean, I just didn't all of a sudden one day say, I'm going to go see this EAP. That's not what happened. What happened was I sold a property, and the proceeds of that property, I took the money. I got the check before my ex-wife did, and I cashed it. And I stayed gone for a long time. As long as that money lasted, I was gone. They filed missing persons reports and all kinds of stuff. And I never will forget coming home from that morning when the money ran out. And talk about the insanity of this disease. I was with two guys, and we were in a motel. And I said, listen, I've got a gun. You guys watch the door, and I'll rob the bank. I said, all you got to do is watch the door. I'll rob the bank. And they said, you're crazy, man. I mean, these two guys drinking like I did, and they weren't crazy as I was. So they got up and left. And they said, this guy's crazy. He's gone. You know, they left. So I got in my car going home, and I kept trying to get up the nerve to run it into a tree or head on into a tractor trailer, but I didn't have the guts to kill myself right out. But I could do it slow with alcohol and stuff like that. But I just didn't have the, you know, I just didn't have the guts, you know, to kill myself. I had to go all the way home, and you can imagine what it was like at home. I don't even have to go into that. Well, my only out was to say I had a problem with alcohol. You know, I had a problem. So I did. My boss came and picked me up and took me to D.C. to a place called New Beginnings. And it had several different floors. The further up you went, the crazier they got. Top floor was alcohol and drug addiction. And I got off. We got off the floor. My boss told me to sit on this couch. And I was sitting on this couch, and there were people were rocking back and forth. And he knocked on this door. It had a little teeny window in it. And there were people out there drooling and stuff like that. I was like, I am not this bad. You know, I really don't. He came, he says, we got to go up one more floor. This is a psychiatric ward. And I thought, we went up to the next floor, and I stayed in there 28 days. Right over Christmas. And, you know, looking back on it now, I got a chance to see exactly what my addiction was doing. I mean, this guy had a company and worked on the railroad regular. I owned a home and all those different things. And my dad had to loan my wife money to buy the kids Christmas stuff because it's all gone. You know, I drank it up. And that was really hard. But, you know, it's not so bad. I mean, if you go through the treatment center, you get to feeling really good. And I got to feeling really good. And I got out of treatment. And it just didn't take. I used to go to one meeting a week, and that was the meeting over in D.C., and we used to meet at a pizza store and talk about all the people that weren't going to make it. You know what I mean? And I have no idea what happened to all those people, but I didn't make it. You know, I sold a bunch of stock, forged my wife's signature, and sold a bunch of railroad stock, bought up a bunch of stuff, and did exactly what I did, and got on the railroad. Well, I never will forget one day I came home. I'd been out of treatment, and we were renting a house now. We had lost our house, and we were renting a place. And I came home and told my wife that I relapsed. And she's like, well, that's it. You know, I'm out of here. And it wasn't shortly after that. I moved out, moved in with my sister. The only place I go, you start living with family. And I moved in with my sister and living in her basement. And now I don't have any responsibilities and stuff like that, and I'm just spending every check I get. You know, I'm not going to court. I'm not doing anything. I'm just working and stuff like that. And for some odd reason, after that relapse, and a lot of different things happened. I mean, there's a lot of points in time happened. But anyway, one morning I was on the way to work, and we used to drive freight trains from Alexandria, Virginia to Roanoke, Virginia. We'd go up there light and come back with coal for Pepco. And for some odd reason, I was at the bank, and I thought, you know, it's Saturday afternoon. I'm going to be in Roanoke on Sunday. I probably should get a half a gallon of liquor to take with me to Roanoke. Now, I don't know why that ever hit me. I've never thought about bringing a half gallon of liquor on a train, but I thought I probably should do that. And I did that, and got a half gallon of liquor, put it in my bag on top of all my stuff, and I hid it in the clothes, and we went to Roanoke. We got there at 4 o'clock in the morning, and we started drinking. Me and this other guy started drinking this liquor. And we ran out. It was about 6 o'clock in the morning. We went down to the restaurant and begged that guy down there at the restaurant to sell us some beer. We bought some beer. And we decided that, you know, we've been up drinking all night long. We should probably take a nap. So we laid down and told ourselves we took a nap. We got up at 12 o'clock that afternoon, and I think we went to bed at 9:45 or 10 o'clock. I mean, it wasn't long. And got up at 10 o'clock. He said, what do you want to do? I said, we should probably go out and eat. And he said, okay. I said, well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I don't know what time they're going to run the train, so I'm going to call the train master and ask him. Never call your boss. You know, I'm starting to get crazy now. You know what I mean? I'm really crazy. So I call up my boss, and the train master answers the phone. I said, what time are y'all going to run the train? He said, well, we don't have enough cars. And I said, well, when do you think you'll run it? He said, I don't know. Why do you want to know? And I said, well, me and this guy that I'm with, we want to go out tonight and have a steak and a few beers. He said, yeah, well, it's not going to be till tomorrow. And I said, okay. Well, you never say that to people. You never do that. But I was crazy. So we went out, and we didn't go to any steak joint. We went to some little dive in Roanoke in the middle of town, and I really don't remember a lot of that. All I know is that I had two ATM receipts in my pocket for $80 at a pop, and I didn't have any money. And I got called at 12 o'clock that night for a train to go to work, and I was totally, I mean, I was just, I can remember standing in the shower saying, oh, God, help me, you know, to get straight. And we went down there, and I was thinking, if I can just get on the train, if I can get on the engines and get out of sight, nobody will know. And we went down to the office, and they didn't have any train orders. They didn't have nothing. You know, there was nothing like normal. So I called up the diesel shop over there to find out what power I was getting on this train. And the guy says, well, the train master will give that to you when he gets there. And I thought, oh, my God, you know, the train master never comes, gives me nothing. You know, he never leaves his office. And so I hung up the phone, and I just looked out the window, and I thought, you know, this is it. You know, it's over with. And he came walking in with two special agents and asked me if I'd go in this back room with him. I went in the back room, and, I mean, my shirt wasn't tucked in. Things were hanging out of my bag. I was putting on this big act, and he says, you don't want to blow my breath in his face? And I said, no, I ain't doing that. And he says, well, how about going to the hospital for a a blood test. And I said, that's fine, I'll do that. And he told me to go to the special agent. We went out, and I went out, and I heard him asking the other guy that I was with. You know, I could hear him in the other room. He says, no, I ain't doing that, you know, and big wall, you know, you're picking on us, you know, and, you know, you're going to owe us the money for taking us off the train and all that stuff. It was no train, it was a ghost train. You know, they just get you on duty, and then they do what they do, and I never will forget, we were driving back, they escorted us off company property, they took blood and urine and all that stuff, and I was in a van on the way back to Potomac Yards, and in Alexandria, and we had been taken out of service, and this guy says, what are we going to do? And I said, I don't know. I opened my wallet up and I had a card from the EAP counselor from the first time that I went in treatment. And I said, here, call this guy. And he looks at it and he goes, oh, my God, this is the best you got? You know, that's all I got. You know, his name was Andrew. That's all I got. So he said, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to just take care of things. And so we got out and he went his way and I went mine. And what I did was went right to Crystal City, got a bunch of money. At the ATM, I went and got a hotel room and left my wallet, my keys, and everything in a truck, walked 4 blocks to a hotel, went in the hotel with nothing in mind but the drink and, you know, drug myself to death. I was going to kill myself. And I'd been in there for a day, and the phone rings. You know, nobody knew I was there, you know, and the phone rings, and it was Andrew. And he said, what are you doing? And I said, who is this? And he said, it's Andrew. I said, what do you want? And he said, they want to help us. And I said, who wants to help us? He said, that guy you told me to call. And I don't remember telling him where I was going or anything. I must have. But anyway, I called him up and said, he was Jerry Eller. And Jerry says, can you drive? And I said, yeah. He said, can you be at the airport tomorrow? I said, well, I'll try. And he said, I need you to be there at 8 o'clock in the morning without fail. I said, okay. So I went to this little airport in Manassas, Virginia. I got my parents to take me. And my dad was crying and my mom was crying. And, you know, it was one of those things. And I'm sitting there in this plane. A small plane pulls in with a horse on it and comes in and makes a turn and it stops and this door falls down and the gentleman walks in and says, we need Wayne Brown. And I said, that's me. And went out there and got on this plane and it revved up and took off and it made a bang toward Maryland. I'm like, what the heck? You know, and when it, you know, it's amazing. I'm on an airplane headed someplace and as the plane bangs in the curve, a drawer slides open. There's 4/5 of liquor. And, my eyes just focused right on that 4/5 of liquor. And one of them was Jack Daniels. I really like that. And the guy looks at me and says, you need a drink? I said, oh, no, I'm fine. You know, wouldn't want you to think I need a drink. You know, he said, I got anything you need. I got a shot for you, whatever you need. I said, oh, I'm fine. You know, I'm good. So we landed over in Maryland. And I never will forget the pilot raising Cain about drawing rocks into the props because it was a jet prop. And he said, this little podunk airport. It's going to ruin these props. So anyway, we landed at the airport, and it was Andrew, the guy that I got fired with. He gets on the plane. We take off, and 45 minutes later, I'm checking into a place in Tarboro, North Carolina, called the Mary Frances Center. And the address was 1212 Recovery Road. And the phone number was 1-800-4-TLC. And isn't that crazy? I mean, this guy by the name of Tom Palmer, he was a president of Ford Motor Company, had gotten fired for drinking on the job. What he did, he knew they were trying to get his job, and he was drinking, and he hid in the boardroom inside the closet when they were having a board meeting because they wanted to find out what they were going to say about him. And they needed an extension cord. When he opened the closet door, he fell out. And he got fired. And this is a guy with a lot of connections, and he started his treatment center. And him and his son ran it, and that's where I was, and I never will forget checking into that place. Of course, we had to go in the back door, and we went into the back door, and a nurse sat me down, and she said, you look bad, and I was in really bad shape, and you can just about imagine trying to kill yourself, the things that I was doing to myself, and she said, do you have a problem with drugs and alcohol? And I said, how much time do you have? That's the first time I've ever been honest with anybody. But you have to understand, I was at the end of the line. I mean, there was nowhere else to go. You know, God had gotten it to the point where only thing I had to look at was me. He took everything else away. It was gone. And I can never will forget the first treatment center I went into, everybody was coming in there saying, oh, I lost my job, I lost this, and I thought, oh, it ain't that bad. You know, I still got some time. And I never will forget this guy said, if you haven't lost it, say yet. Because the yets will get you, and the yets got me. And so anyway, we checked in, and by now I'm starting to detox. They gave us some shots. and they detoxed me over 5 days. And I had to start attending men's groups and stuff like that. And it's funny. I mean, this place was in two wings with a big circle in the middle. The right was women and the left was men. And I copped an attitude right off the bat because they said, well, anybody that had a relapse, please meet in the women's sunroom. And I thought, well, that's a disgrace. Make a man walk through the women's to the sunroom just because you relapsed? That's disgraceful, you know what I mean? I had to go to this relapse thing every time. But I started having a problem with my back, and my neck was hurting, and my fingers were going to sleep, and I kept knocking on this big glass window. All the nurses and doctors behind this big, thick glass, and I'd knock, and they'd slide this thing up and say, can we help you? And I said, I need something for pain. And she'd say, so does everybody out there, you know? And I said, no, I'm serious. I mean it. She goes, yeah, so do they, you know? And they didn't take me serious for about 5 days. Then they took me to Nash General Hospital in Wilmington. And sure enough, I had two herniated discs in my neck. And they said they'd been herniated for quite some time. But see, I was so inebriated, so drunked up, and it had taken so much, so I didn't even know I had two herniated discs. You know, and when I got sobered up, I started hurting, you know. And, well, of course, they took those out, and that extended my stay because they gave me stuff for pain in the hospital. And, you know, this big, huge wall of denial. I never will forget, this guy comes in, and he was the anesthesiologist. And a treatment center brought me there. A treatment center checked me in. And this anesthesiologist comes in, and he says, now, we need to know, do you have any problem with drugs and alcohol? I said, no. And, you know, he says, need you to be honest because I need to know how much to give you to knock out. I said, I don't have a problem with it. And, you know, he said, okay. You know, so they knew how much to knock me out if they knocked me out. But, you know, I was just afraid to tell him the truth. I didn't want anybody on the outside of the treatment center to know I was a problem drinker and all that stuff. And they did the work, and I had to stay extra time at Mary Frances Center. And I never will forget, they flew me back, and they flew me back into Dulles Airport. And my dad picked me up. My dad and mom picked me up. And I didn't have anywhere to go. And they lived in Fredericksburg. My dad was retired now. And we went there, and I got this collar on my neck, and I was all pitiful looking. And we went in there, and my dad says, you drive. And I used to hate to drive for my dad. See, once he's got you busy like that, he can just tell you what he thinks. You know what I mean? Can't turn your head or nothing like that. And so I knew what was coming. So all the way from Dulles to Fredericksburg, I had to get this earful. And he told me things like, the only reason why you're coming to the house is because your mother wants you there. I don't trust you and I don't like you. One slip up, you're out the door. One for your mother, you wouldn't get this. Told me things like that. That's what the father told me, you know. But that's how much I had hurt him, you know. And I never will forget. I went there and spent the night there that night. And the next morning I got up and went to a went to a meeting. It was a 12 o'clock meeting at this place up on, I forget the name of it, but it was at a park place. Anyway, I went in there and I sat on the outside of the wall. And a guy by the name of Jerry asked me if I had a problem, you know, with alcohol and stuff like that. I said, yeah, I got a problem. He said, well, come on, sit up to the table. And I sat up to the table, and they asked me what my problem was. I said it was my ex-wife, and they all said, oh, right, you know, we'll pray for her. I said, no, I ain't praying for her, you know. And I told them the situation and all that stuff, and they all told me to keep coming back, of course. And I kept coming back. And I went to a place at the hospital, and it was the old hospital, and this was about a month in. And I was sitting there, and there was this little skinny guy. His name was Todd. And Todd had a hair lip, and he always wore a white hat, had a Texaco sign on it. And he always, the jeans were pressed. I mean, he was clean as a pin. His work boots were clean. I mean, he looked good. And he came up to me and says, he used to call me fella. He says, fella, you got a sponsor? And I said, no, sir, I don't. He said, well, pick me up tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock on Rose Street. I said, okay. And that morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, I went and picked Todd up. And we left. We left from there, and we went up to a place called Aquia Harbor. And he was the manager of a gas station, not literally the manager, his wife was, but what he did was maintenance. And he said, what I want you to do is go over there and get that cart. He said, I'm going to show you some things. Well, the cart had cleaning stuff on it, you know, like trash bags and toilet brushes and all that stuff. And I thought, what does he want me to do with this? So I got it. I mean, he told me to do it. I'm supposed to follow instructions, so I got it. And I pushed it out there, and he says, come on. So he went down to this place, and it was a men's room on one side, ladies' room on the other side. He said, I want you to take that cart, block that door open, put this sign up that says, use men's room. And he said, I want you to go in the ladies' room, I want you to clean it. He said, I want you to clean the toilets. And he said, I want you to fill the toilet paper thing. And he said, I want you to clean the grout. He said, I want you to get on the floor, clean all that stuff around that toilet. He said, when you get down, I want you to do the men's room. And I said, I don't do that. I said, I'm a railroad engineer. He said, no, you're a fire drunk. And he said, you need to be humble. He said, you need to start right here. So that's what I did. I went there and cleaned the ladies' room, and I went and cleaned the men's room. And I did it every day. We left there and went to Earl's Market, another place over in, under the bridge, and I cleaned that bathroom. And he told me that if I did it really well and behaved myself, one day he would let me use the backpack blower to get the trash up. See, he wouldn't let me use the blower. I had to walk around and pick it up. And he didn't give me one of them picker things either. I had to walk around with my hand, pick up the trash, pull it out of bushes and stuff like that. And I never will forget, because, see, I was a railroad engineer. I didn't do trash. I didn't clean bathrooms. And here I was doing trash cleaning bathrooms. And, you know, it really tore my heart up, because, you know, the whole time I'm cleaning bathrooms and picking up trash, people are pulling through with their families, kids in the car and stuff like that. That's what I drank away. You know, exactly that. I drank it away. And it was killing me. And we would drive back and forth. He'd ask me, he said, you doing any steps? And I said, no. He says, well, you've done one and two. There's no question about it. You know, you've admitted you got a problem. And he says, you're crazy. You're in hell, and you know it. And the only thing that's going to help you with it is God. And he says, that's what you need to get in touch with. He said, I want you to figure out how you're going to do that. You know, he said, I'm not talking about them mug things that you do when you're down on the floor holding the toilet. And I don't want you to talk, you know, not that God you pray to when you're in trouble and just help me get out when you make deals. I want you to find out how to get in touch with God. And he says, you can call him your higher power. He says, now don't fall in love with a coffee cup or a tree branch or any of that stuff. It might move. He says, you need something solid. You need to get God in your life. And that's what I did. You know, I did that for a while. And he said, the reason why you feel so bad, Wayne, is because your life is eat up with regret. He said, you're sober now and you can't drink away all that regret. He says, you're looking back every day and you regret it. You feel bad about it. And he says, you need to get some of that out. And he says, I suggest you start making a little inventory. And he says, I'm not talking about one of them Hazleton things or any of that stuff. I'm talking about exactly what's in the big book. He said, it's very easy. You find it. You go to step meetings. And he says, I want you to find that four step in there and go through there. And he says, you know, they have all these little parts in there about, you know, what it was affecting and all that stuff. And he says, then I want you to think about what your part was and all that stuff. You know, what you did. What was your part in causing all these things? And I did all that. And it wasn't my first four step. I mean, I was in treatment before, and I had done another four step. And that four step was a big lie. And I just wrote stuff down to make the guy get off my back. And I never will forget that I went to, his name was Ken, and I went to his house, and he had made a pot of coffee and made his wife leave to go on a shopping trip. And I wasn't even there 15 minutes. I didn't drink a cup of coffee. That's all it took me to do a four-step with him. And but you understand, I mean, I got exactly what I did. Nothing. I relapsed and went back out, drank away my life. And anyway, I went on ahead and did this four-step, and I got with Todd, and I did a fifth step. And, you know, I didn't feel really great about it. I mean, I told him stuff that I hadn't told anybody else. I admitted stuff that I hadn't admitted to anybody else. And once I looked at it, it was really bad looking at my part of it. But I didn't get that, you know, that, oh, boy, I'm free and happy to go running. You know what I mean? Well, I didn't get that. And he said it would take time. You know, he said, eventually you'll be able to talk about these things in meetings. And he says, it's not going to be something you'll plan. It's just going to fly out of your mouth. He said, it's going to fly out of your mouth when you're helping another person. And you're going to say, why did I say that? But he said, somebody's going to come in with your exact situation, and you won't be ashamed to talk to him about it. Because he's going to be dying just like you were when you came in here. And, you know, that thing actually happened to me. I've actually had people coming in, and they're talking about doing the things that I did, and how am I going to get out of this, and how is this going to happen? And I was able to say, well, this is what happened to me. It was all those big, dark secrets that I was afraid to talk about. See, but when I did that fourth and fifth step, it took the big burden off. You know, that part in the big book that says, you know, we will not regret the past, nor should shut the door on it. Well, I didn't anymore. It was part of my past. It's what got me here. It's what made me who I am today. And it gave me the courage to share that with somebody else. And I used to do that in meetings, too. We'd be sharing in meetings, and I would say something that, you know, I did in the past, and I'm like, oh, my God. You know, I used to look around the room to see somebody that would throw me out or say, you're too sick for us, pal, you know. But that never happened. And I went home and did a 6 and 7 step and, you know, making amends to all these people and stuff like that. I did all that, and it was a long process. You know, Amy and I today, my wife Amy, we were home today, and we had some time. We're trying to clean this room up for an office, and I went through the file cabinet, and I had stuff in there that was back to 1987. And 89 is when I went through my first treatment center. My sobriety date is 1990, March 8th. And, boy, going through that, some of that stuff, it was like, holy cow, man. You know, I'm talking about life insurance policies that I drank away that I had on both my sons, and cashed out bonds that I was saving for their college, a receipt for all that stuff. I mean, I drank all that stuff away, and here I am shredding the evidence. You know, I'm shredding all the stuff away. And because it was over. I mean, that part of my life was over. I have no idea why I carried all those things around. But I have been carrying this stuff around for years. And it was a 50-gallon bag, trash bag full of stuff. But after working with Todd and making amends to some of these people, financial amends to my dad, you know, I never will forget my brother. I have a brother that I bummed the money from and never paid him back. I told him, I said, I'm going to start mailing you a check every month. And when it's over, when I've done enough, you tell me it's over. And I did that with my dad. And I never will forget, my wife and I were coming back. We went on a vacation, and we came back and I had money left. And she said, you know, and I was trying to think, what do I do with this money? But I felt bad doing anything with the money because I owed people money for the financial amends. I drove right to my dad's house. Amy and I went in there and saw him, and I think it was $1,500 or $1,000. I forget the amount, but I gave it to my dad. And I never will forget my dad. One day he came out to me to the car, and Amy and I were leaving, and he hands me this little envelope, and on this little envelope was every date and every amount that I had borrowed from him. And he wrote paid in full. And I thought, God, you know, paid in full, paid that amends, I paid it to my brother, paid him up. And there's one guy out there, and going through this, I had this huge thing for bankruptcy, which happened years and years ago, and this guy was on it. I need to find this guy. I owe him $2,500. If I can find him, I'll mail him a check and just get that over. Because I keep thinking about it. He's the last one. He's out there, that little beast, that one last stone. You know, after all this time, I've got to find him, and I'll find him and mail him his check. But after getting with this guy and getting in recovery, Todd, by the way, he came down with cancer, and he died at the VA hospital in Stanton. And I never will forget, I spent a lot of time with him right toward the end there. And he would ask me, you know, he'd be in pain. He said, do you think it's a relapse if I take this medicine? I said, no, Todd, not if you're hurt. You know, that's what the bottle says, ain't it? And we're supposed to follow directions, take as needed for pain. He said, I said, you're hurting? He said, yeah. I said, here, take a spoonful. It was liquid morphine. And he would take that stuff and fall out for a while. And then he'd wake up, and we'd watch some more tapes and talk about recovery and what he'd done in his life and how he was proud of this lawnmower that he rebuilt and all these different things, because Todd was a pretty simple guy. He never owned a lot. He was renting the house that he lived in. His mother lived with him, and he had me to drag around. And see, Todd didn't drive. He drank away his license. He was a habitual offender, and he didn't drive. And when he picked me in the meeting that day, he knew I had a vehicle. So he needed a ride, and I needed recovery. So, you know, the two of us just messed together. And we got into some really good stuff. I met another guy by the name of Tommy Robinson later on, and Tommy is still a person that I talk to a lot. And Tommy taught me a lot of neat things, like how to save money. See, I had a hard time saving money. And now I'm dating a lady in the program, and I needed to save money to be able to take her out and buy her gifts and stuff like that. See, I'm still one of them people that flash, need a lot of shiny stuff, you know what I mean? And he says, well, I'll tell you what you do. He says, stop using change. You know, he says, if you go into a store and it's $1.09, I want you to give the guy $2, all the change in your pocket at the end of the day, I want you to put that in a can. At the end of the month, I want you to put that change in the bank. He said, at the end of the year, you'll have enough money to take her out to a nice vacation. And I thought, that's ridiculous. But he told me to do it, and we're supposed to do what we're told. So I did that. And it's funny, at the end of the year, I had $1,000. that change actually adds up to a lot of money. And we still do it today. I still do it. It's just a habit that I've gotten into. And sure enough, it worked. And this little truck that I had that the IRS had a lien on, see, there's only a piece of property I had left, and the IRS had a lien on it. The carburetor went bad, and they were $1,000. And he told me I had to go to a bank and tell the man what my problem was, and I wanted to borrow the money. And here I am, bankrupt, in recovery, and there's no bank that'll loan me money. Well, the guy did. I did exactly what he told me, and the guy loaned me the money to buy a carburetor for my truck. And I just can't believe the things that this guy taught me, you know, the courage. See, I didn't have any self-esteem, but he had enough for me. You know, he said, go in there and hold your head up high and tell him you're drunk. Tell him